Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Michael Truesdale from here in Austin. Mike, we're glad to have you on the show.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Well, before we launch into a few things that we've talked about visiting with you about today, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, and what brought you into the law?
Sure. Well, I went to Texas Tech University and was a debater there. I was on the debate team. And after I graduated from Tech, I stayed at Tech and went to graduate school in the English department. But I was also tapped to be the kind of the assistant debate coach. And so I took courses in rhetorical criticism that complemented literary criticism that I was taking in the English department and was the debate coach for 3 years, 2 years while I was in grad school, and then another year just as a lecturer when I graduated. I always thought my career was going to be as a collegiate debate coach and really enjoyed that and went to tournaments all the time. And I spent a great bit of time over at the Texas Tech Law School doing research for either academic papers that I was working on or for topics that the students were debating. And at some point, it occurred to me that if I were going to stay with debate as a professional career, I needed to decide to go to either graduate school to get a PhD or to get a terminal degree offered by some other alternative. And I knew a lot of my colleagues that were coaches. We're coaches with JDs, and they were on tenure tracks with JDs. And so I came home one day and I said, I think I want to go to law school. And my thought was I was going to go to law school so I could become a full-time debate coach. And then basically on the second day of law school, I attended a demonstrative moot court presentation. I just loved it. It was kind of like the grown-up version of what I was doing as a debate coach. You know, it had real-world implications, teamwork, everything about it, I just fell in love with. And so I kind of devoted my spare time in law school to working on moot court teams. I did law review at Tech and other things, but really my heart was with the appellate advocacy program. And I was very much blessed with two colleagues, my third year in law school. They were both 2Ls, but we really excelled in a lot of different competitions and ended up going to the ADA. And we won the ADA competition in 1994, basically outstanding oral advocacy by my colleagues. But so my interest in appellate law kind of led me to seek a judicial clerkship at the Supreme Court of Texas. I interviewed with a number of the justices and Craig Enoch offered me a position. And so my first job out of Lubbock with the Supreme Court of Texas working for Justice Enoch. And so we moved to Austin in 94 and I've been doing appellate law ever since.
Well, and I guess we could skip ahead in the story a little bit because you now are back working with Justice Enoch. Is that correct?
That's correct. And just kind of as a background, after my clerkship, I went to work for Hughes and Luce here in Austin for a year. Well, for more than a year, and really focused on appellate law. And there were trial matters that I got deeply involved with that took me away from Austin for a long time. But my heart was always with the appellate stuff. And so I worked with Hughes and Luce until 2000. And in 2000, a group of eight attorneys at Hughes and Luce left to form a firm called Diamond McCarthy. And I worked with Diamond McCarthy for 10 years. I was one of the starting attorneys, and I worked with them for 10 years. And Diamond McCarthy's was pretty much on what we called, like, who killed the company litigation. And when we started, this was around the time of Enron. There were a lot of like corporate cases where, you know, malfeasance either by auditors or attorneys or other directors and officers, you know, caused the demise of a company, caused harm to investors. And that was kind of our bread and butter. It got to the point, though, and I still emphasized my work on appellate as much as I could. I gave arguments in the Seventh Circuit. I gave arguments in East Lansing, Michigan, at the Halls of Justice, which was their appellate court is called. And I always thought I was going to see like Aquaman walk out of a door or something. In California, we did cases there. But there was a period where I spent more time and made more appearances in the bankruptcy court of Chicago than I spent in any Texas appellate court. And that kind of led me to really, and that was right around when I got board certified. And it just kind of really made me think about, you know, what am I doing with respect to my emphasis? And I really wanted to focus my emphasis on appellate law. And so in 2010, I hung my own shingle and I officed with Doug Alexander and his group for a year and a half, maybe. And then I moved to another location downtown and practiced as a solo until 2017. And you're right, Todd, I kept in touch with my good Justice Enoch. And, you know, we had lunches and we talked about, you know, the pros and cons of being an appellate, a solo, you know, the pros being that, you know, I could control my docket. I could control how I took a case as a flat fee or a contingency or some hybrid. And the cons being that, you know, sometimes it was feast or famine. You know, the workload would be huge at times. And then at other times, you know, you'd be in a valley. And so we talked about that for a little bit. And it just, we kind of discussed whether it would make sense for me to come over to his firm and kind of fill the valleys with working on matters with him and with his firm. And then use their resources when I was at the peak to kind of help level up my stuff. And so in 2017, I went over and joined the Enoch Kiever. And so I've been there ever since. So
I think it's really cool that you started off your legal career working for Justice Enoch. I think you were 1 year ahead of me at the Supreme Court. And then all these years later, you know, you maintain a relationship with your mentor, now your friend and appellate colleague, and have managed to work with him again in a situation that I can only imagine. I guess calling it an appellate lawyer's dream might be a little extreme. I'm not sure what that really looks like. It looks like different things to different people, I think. But it's a great story to me to have you go back and work with Justice Enoch. And they've built a great practice over there. I've watched them start up from scratch. And, you know, they're a real powerhouse in appellate circles. And I know they do a lot of government relations work, too. So it's a great shop.
Well, it really is. And I'm blessed to work with a lot of just absolutely top-notch lawyers, you know, obviously Justice Enoch and then all of the other appellate folks in our group. I am humbled to be with them because, you know, they're just the best of the best. And I learn stuff from them every day. We kind of have an email group. We call it the Brain Trust, you know, and it's just basically like that, you know, does anybody know, you know, this is my peculiar situation. And particularly we've been doing that since we don't have the water cooler to walk around as much given COVID, but what a great, smart group of people there are there. And the appellate folks are great. I've worked with some of the other folks in government relations. They're just the top of the top as well. And the staff there is phenomenal. I have never worked for a better group of people or with a better group of people than I have at Enoch Kiever.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, Litigation Analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with Litigation Analytics on Westlaw Edge.
Has it turned out like you thought? I mean, you've been in it now, I guess you're in their fourth year or so, because people who listen to the show may know that my path kind of did something similar. You know, I was at a firm, not multiple firms, but then I hung my own shingle and did that for quite a long time. And then just recently, for many of the same reasons that you described, came back into a firm. And so has it worked out kind of the way you thought that you'd be able to capitalize on the firm's resources for when you're in the hill part of your practice? And then when the valleys come around as they inevitably do, you know, you have the capacity to fill needs that other people have in the firm.
It has, very much so. I mean, I've taken leadership on a number of cases where the staffing was kind of stretched at the firm. And I have always had no problem accessing either support staff or, you know, junior lawyers to help me with matters. But I brought in, as an aside, and we'll talk about this when we talk about, my other personal interests. A couple of years ago, I broke my hip. And I know you had issues as well, Todd, but as I'm recouping from a broken hip, you know, I had no problems whatsoever enlisting staff to help me or attorneys to help me with a very important mandamus that I'd just been hired to handle. And we decided that with anesthesia, it probably made more sense for this other person to take the lead on it while I was under the weather. So,
yeah, we can form a club, Mike, the aging surgical candidate appellate lawyers club. And it's not something I've talked about on the podcast before, but we definitely have that in common. For me, fortunately, it wasn't a broken hip, but it was something really equally unpleasant. But we're good now. We've recovered more or less. And
well, yeah, exactly. I mean, the biggest impediment now is that I just look the TSA people in the eye and just say, all right, just get your wand out, because when I come through there, you're going to be wanding me down. So,
yeah, the word bionic, takes on a little different meaning to you. Or
exactly.
I mean, that people ask if you have implants or something like that. That's, you have to disclose that. But at any rate, so no, that's great to hear, because, a lot of people see, well, we hear a lot of discussion about, I want to have my own shop someday. And there really is a lot of truth to it. Being sort of idyllic in some ways, you control your own schedule, you only answer your clients in the court. There's big benefits to that, but it's also a very lonely existence. And the law is already a lonely existence in some ways. And so I think it's great, for you to have gone and made that move. And it's just kind of funny, because I don't know if you heard this from other people the way that I did, but some people ask me, well, why would you do that when you make a move like that? Why would you subject yourself to billable hour requirements and, policies and partnership committees and, management committees and that sort of thing. And my answer really is just that it's all a trade-off. It really is. You can certainly weather through the hills and valleys easier in a situation like what you've gone into. So sounds like it's worked out great, and I'm super happy for you.
Well, it is. Thank you very much, Todd. Yeah, no, it's been a great experience, and nothing but good things to say. So,
well, we really asked you, I've been wanting to have you on the show anyway, Mike, because you're a very experienced appellate lawyer. I like hearing your stories about going off to different states and working on these cases back in your Diamond McCarthy days. I think I saw recently that firm is still around. I know there was a lot of transition and change there for some time, but I saw their name pop up. Just that was what I knew them to be known for, is the kind of disputes that you talked about. But so in addition to your experience as an appellate practitioner, there was the thing that really prompted us to reach out to you about coming on the show was the state of Texas, I think, largely has Mike Truesdale to thank for the State Bar Appellate Pro Bono Program. I don't want to call you the grandfather of the program. Maybe the father of the program would be more appropriate.
I'm pretty much the nephew of the program.
Tell us about it. Let's just start from the beginning.
Yeah, sure. There were pro bono programs that were well established before I ever got involved with pro bono at the state bar level. The Austin Court of Appeals had a program that they worked with the state bar, the local bar association, and with the courts to create a pro bono program that was really kind of the model for how programs have been implemented across the state. And the way that program at its inception started to work was, if a pro se party was interested in obtaining the services of a pro bono counsel during the appeal, they could inform the clerk's office when they filled out their docketing statement. And if they completed, if they indicated as much, then the clerk of the third court would forward the information, the request, to a committee that was set up. And that committee would kind of screen the application to make sure that the pro se litigant was in fact qualified financially. And they would do a preliminary review of, the merits of the case. If it was filed 6 years after the deadline for the filing of the notice of appeal, they'd probably sit on it. But otherwise, they would refer it to a listserv of volunteers. And the state bar has accumulated a substantial database with names of volunteers and their emails who have indicated their willingness to participate as pro bono counsel in matters on appeal. And so the screening committee would review the matter, and if it was appropriate for a pro bono placement, they would send an email blast to all of the volunteers and say, case 03, 14-00014, is pending before the Third Court of Appeals. Pro se party is seeking appellate counsel. You know, here's the docketing statement. Here's a little bit of background. If you're interested in serving as a pro bono counsel, you know, please contact the committee. So an attorney would respond, and attorney would be put in contact with the pro se client. You know, they could talk about whether the pro bono counsel was willing to go forward. The pro bono counsel had access to talk with the trial lawyer, if in fact there was one, to get a sense of, you know, what are the issues. And the court was very generous in terms of its participation and its cooperation with making this program efficient, because what the court ended up doing is basically agreeing that if a case that was pending at the court was referred to the pro bono program and a volunteer lawyer agreed to serve as pro bono counsel, the court would not guarantee oral argument, but it would give preference to oral argument in such cases. And the upside to that was that with oral arguments being as scarce as they are and were, and with oral arguments being a key requirement to getting board certification, many appellate lawyers would agree, and very qualified lawyers, I mean, this isn't riffraff, but very qualified lawyers would agree to take a case so that they could get the opportunity to give oral argument. And so I am just laughed at because I say this so often. It's a win-win-win program. It's a win for the pro se litigant because the pro se litigant gets to have its or his or her matter presented to the court by a qualified lawyer, and, you know, that's going to do the homework, make sure there's, you know, right standard of review, proper issues, and everything like that, and not make an 88-page handwritten brief with crayon or something like that that, you know, it's just impossible to get anywhere with. It's a win for the court and the court staff precisely because they're not going to get the handwritten crayon brief that's gobbledygook. They're going to get a good, competent brief like they get in the cases that they expect from a good, qualified lawyer. And it is a win for the lawyer who's volunteering because the lawyer gets the opportunity and the exposure of getting to handle an appeal that the lawyer may not otherwise get given their level of experience with a firm or given their level, you know, given realities of the court in terms of how often they'll take cases. So everybody benefits from it. And I have had talks with clerks at various courts about the program. And I'll back up to this in a minute, but I've had talks with various clerks of the courts that indicate the administrative burden on the clerks is de minimis. It's a very little impact on the courts in terms of how much time and effort they have to spend to accommodate the request for pro se counsel or pro se litigants seeking pro bono counsel. Because all they have to do is just like, all right, when they're reviewing the docketing statement and they're inputting the data they're going to input anyway, if section 10 of the docketing statement is checked, then they'll note, all right, we're going to email this to the, we'll make a note on the file and we'll email this off. And then the commission will report back, you know, we weren't able to place this and then we'll just keep it going, or they are able to place it and somebody will file a notice of appearance. So I'll segue a little bit more into how that program expanded from my view and from my participation. So that's why I'm not the grandfather or the father. I'm the nephew. I have nothing to do with that. And it was put in by people with greater brains than mine and really had great ideas and a program in place.
You need to take a little more credit than that, though, because hopefully what you're about to do is to explain how that program from the Third Court of Appeals really blew up and expanded into other courts, including our Supreme Court.
Well, okay. So in like 2011, 2012, that time frame, I started working. I was then like a co-chair of the pro bono appellate section of the state bar. And I started working with Blake Hawthorne on coming up with some solution to the number of handwritten petitions for review that were filed with the court. When I was a solo and I could do this, I kind of kept a track of all e-briefs that were being filed and, you know, just kind of go down them chronologically. And it just astonished me that in one period, something like, I forget the numbers, but it's something like 36% of the petitions for review were handwritten, or they were by pro se parties. And, you know, around that time, the Supreme Court came up with its pro bono, at that time, their pilot program. And the pilot program was basically set up so that if a petition for review proceeded to the point where briefing on the merits was requested, and either party was a pro se litigant, the Supreme Court would refer the matter to a pro bono committee, and that pro bono liaison. And I've been serving as the liaison since 2011. But the liaison would then reach out to the members of the listserv and say, you know, the Supreme Court has requested briefing on the merits in this case involving a pro se party. If you're interested in serving as pro bono counsel, please let me know and I will put you in touch. And when I would send those emails out, I would literally hit send, go get a cup of coffee, and come back, and I would have five Texas lawyers volunteer to say, I will take this case, which is, it says so much about the Texas appellate bar that they're willing to do that, you know? And I mean, I guess in a selfish way, if the Supreme Court is looking for counsel because briefing on the merits has been requested, you know, that's an indication that this is a case that has the Supreme Court's attention. So it's a good case to get involved in. So, but if you're going to get involved, that's the way to do it. So the problem that Blake and I talked about was that pro bono pilot program really kind of addressed the need for pro bono counsel once a brief on the merit was requested. And it didn't really do anything at the front end in terms of like helping the person prepare a petition that might generate a request for briefing on the merits. And so I worked with Blake and we came up with some templates that were on the Supreme Court's website. And they were all blessed by the Supreme Court. The justices reviewed them and made comments to everything. And they participated very heavily as well. But the templates basically provide almost a fill-in-the-blank way to start a petition for review. You know, these are the sections that you need. You know, you need to put the district court's name here. You need to put the Court of Appeals name here. What is the issue? What are you complaining about? You know, and it was just a good way for people to say, like, all right, if I'm going to file a petition, this is what it should look like. And so Blake and I worked on that. And while we were working on that, I was over at the court one day and, you know, he talked about a call that the court received from a pro se litigant in Canadian, Texas, who only spoke Spanish and was looking for a pro bono lawyer to help her in a divorce appeal pending before the Amarillo Court of Appeals. And Blake, you know, and Bianca both were saying, you know, it's just a shame that there's no pro bono program up there. And, you know, and I just said, well, Blake, I can get a lawyer for you. I can get a lawyer for that client in a heartbeat. So when I got back to my office, I sent an email to the listserv. And I just said, you know, there's a litigant in Amarillo that needs a pro bono counsel and a divorce appeal. And, you know, and I got contacted by a junior lawyer at Vincent & Elkins in Houston, Texas, who said, I will take this case, and took it and, you know, handled it from top to bottom. And I just thought that was just amazing that our volunteers could do that. And so that led me to thinking, you know, by that time, the Third Courts program had kind of expanded. There was one in Dallas. There were some other programs in some of the more populated areas. But I did some looking and I said, like, the demographics of Texas where the Court of Appeals did have pro bono programs basically reflected something like, 60% of all civil appellate filings in a given year, you know, between the metropolitan areas. And those 60% of litigants had access to appellate pro bono counsel. But what that told me was that that meant that, and the numbers are not right, but that told me that 40% of Texans did not have access to appellate pro bono programs. And you ought not have your litigation decided differently because you live in Texarkana than if you live in Garland, you know? And so I was trying to think about how we could address that. And I coordinated with Blake, and I went to the Appellate Court Clerks Conference in Houston. I think the first time I did that was in 2012. And I basically walked through the same spiel I'm giving you guys now and just said, you know, this program is easy. Jeff Kyle was there. And I said, you know, he can vouch for how administratively easy this is to administer.
Yeah, Jeff Kyle's the clerk of the Third Court of Appeals, just for everyone's clarification.
And so I just said, the only thing that really caused a burden on you is when the Office of Court Administration is about to make the changes to the docketing statement. You know, right now the docketing statement has a pro bono section on it, but it says, if you're a litigant in the 3rd, 5th, 1st, 14th Court of Appeals, please read below. Otherwise, go to the next section. And I just said, you know, if you guys want to participate, you don't have to have your own program. We'll take care of that for you if you'll just put your name on that docketing statement. And so if people come in and ask you, just tell them, yes, give me your name and we'll forward your information on. And so with that in mind, we started getting more and more requests from litigants and from clerks in, you know, El Paso and Corpus and elsewhere. And, you know, and then some courts opted to create their formal program, their own formal program, like they did in Amarillo. But the point is that through doing that, we were really able to provide access to appellate pro bono counsel to litigants from Texarkana to Tyler to Waco or wherever the need exists. If they wanted it, they could get it. So that was kind of the gist of the expansion of the pro bono program.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com. I was looking at a docketing statement, and for those who don't practice in Texas, that's our docketing statement is basically just an administrative tool where parties provide basic information about the case to the court so that all the information can be entered into the court's docket and the appropriate people contacted and the court know a little bit about the case. But I saw on the form that I was just looking at, there are still several of our courts of appeals that aren't on that list. And so is it that they have created their own program separate and apart from the program that you helped to get going? Or there's some metro areas, you know, I'll call out the 4th Judicial District. You know, it's the 4th Court of Appeals is not there.
We are working with San Antonio right now on this very project. The co-chair of the appellate session and I have been in contact with Justice Watkins, and there's an enthusiastic interest in it. It's just sometimes things move slowly, but we expect to get that something taken care of relatively soon with them. But, you know, they have to coordinate with all the courts. And I will tell you, this is kind of a, you know, I don't want to show my hand too much, but a number of years ago, contacted a chief judge, the chief justice in Eastland. And I said, you know, what advice do you give? Can you give to me about making this pitch to the courts? And it was Bud Arnott. And his advice was talk to the chief clerk. Sell it to the clerk, and the clerk will bring it to us. You know, it's something that I'm going to say this wrong, and I don't offend anybody. It's detached enough from the realities of what happens in the clerk's office that we really don't have a dog in that hunt. But the clerks do. It's going to impact them more than it's going to impact us in terms of the workload. So if you can sell to them, they will sell to us, and we can, you know, back such a type of a program. And I thought that was a very helpful advice because, you know, when I made these pitches to, you know, the clerks, either in Houston at the conference or in Fort Worth at the conference, you know, it was the clerks and the staff attorneys that were following up with me and saying, yeah, I'd like to contact you on this. I want more information because we can make this happen. So, the program has worked well. We get a recognition from pro bono programs, basically in bar associations from across the country. I've talked with bar association leaders from, I did a presentation with the Hawaii pro bono group in Pittsburgh a couple of years ago. And we were just talking about, you know, how it's done in Texas versus Hawaii, you know, two completely different sized states in terms of population, in terms of bar relationships. I have talked with representatives from, you know, from Montana. The Austin Bar Association, the civil appellate section of the Austin Bar Association has more appellate lawyers than the state of Montana, you know, and so what works for the great state of Texas may not work elsewhere, but it has good ideas. You know, the involvement, the interplay between the Bar Association that wants to work on this, the courts, and the members who are going to volunteer, you know, those three groups together, working together, can make a program successful, regardless if you're in Texas or in Wyoming or anywhere else. So
I've been on the screening committee for the Fort Worth Court of Appeals pro bono program for years, and it is interesting. And we don't delve into the merits, really, unless there's just something that's totally obvious that's a defect or something. But, you know, it really is. We just kind of look at it and does it meet the requirements? Has the person filed their affidavit of indigent, you know, all the checklist things. And then if it does, then we farm it out. And more often than not, somebody takes those cases, typically, if they get farmed out from us.
That's exactly right. And I wish I had numbers to give you guys now about the number of cases that we place every year. I used to be on top of that when I was the one that filled out the malpractice insurance, which is also a perk that I haven't talked about. If you participate in the program, you receive malpractice insurance provided by the State Bar of Texas. So, but every year we fill out those applications and we would have to list the number of you know, ballpark number of appeals and kind of a breakdown of the types of cases. And, you know, some of the cases are, a lot of them are family law. A lot of them are just heartbreaking. A lot of them are people that screwed up and got the record wrong when they went to appeal to the Court of Appeals, or they missed their appellate briefing deadline. And there's not much you can do, but sometimes you can, you know, and a lot of family law, a lot of cases that, you know, just heartbreaking. And it's really good to see that the bar is stepping up to provide representation in some of the most important cases that you'll ever handle. And if you've handled a pro bono appeal, you know, I've handled just a ton of appeals and I hate to lose appeals. But when I do, you know, there are times where I tell a client that you're not going to get that check that you thought you were, and it's bitter pill. But, you know, when you can tell a pro bono client that, you know, yes, they do get to keep their kid or they're going to get their Social Security benefits or something, that's just remarkable. I mean, there's nothing that feels better, you know, so.
What would you say to someone who maybe hasn't done a lot of appeals but wants to get into it? You know, are there fail safes in the program to keep somebody who doesn't necessarily know what they're doing out there?
We have set it up so that if a party wants to take an appeal but doesn't have a lot of experience, there are other folks who have said, like, I've volunteered to assist on this case. I don't want to first chair it, but if there's a, you know, a baby lawyer that wants to experience, I'll be happy to mentor them. And, you know, what a great experience, you know, working with a lawyer from another firm that's going to give you skill sets that you may not otherwise get, you know, or insights that you may not otherwise get, you know, when you're captive to your the group in your shop.
It combines a couple of our favorite things on our show, access to justice and mentoring. So that's a wonderful combination. So that, you know, younger or less experienced attorneys can actually dip their toe in the water for handling appeals. And you pointed out, Mike, getting the benefit of preferential treatment for oral argument. I mean, it's a great way for someone to do just that, to get some experience writing briefs and handling appeals first chair, which in a lot of practice settings is very, very difficult to do because the money is just so significant that's at stake. The younger lawyer is not often put in that situation unless they're being closely supervised. So it really is a wonderful program.
As you say, Todd, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is a little bit different. But every time I've argued before the Fifth Circuit, before I have given my argument, one of the cases inevitably involves a court-appointed attorney because of conflicts that the public defender couldn't represent the criminal defendant. And the courts are uniformly generous in their thanks to the attorneys that do the job, because, you know, when I've been appointed to handle a criminal appeal, I don't know anything about some of these areas, but I'm going to make sure that when I go to federal court that the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. And so it may be not the most efficient thing in the world, and I'm not yet paid for it. I'm going to do the homework. And that's how a lot of these litigants are. And I know that the Texas appellate courts feel the same way with attorneys that physically volunteer to handle appeals. They're very appreciative, and they're always very quick to note that for the record.
The two of you can educate me on this process a little bit, because it's been a while since I've taken a case in the program. But is there any centralization of the assignment or the intake of the pro bono case? Or, like, we've sort of merged the Supreme Court pilot program, it seems like, with some of what was going on in the Third Court of Appeals, and then expanded it beyond, of course, the Third Court. We've got the first and the 14th in Houston, the second in Fort Worth, the fifth in Dallas, and a few others that are handling these cases. So how is that handled? Does it depend on the local bar, having a local bar representative, like someone like Jody, who is doing this on a volunteer basis in Tarrant County or in the Second Court of Appeals District, or is someone doing it more on a statewide basis like you used to do, Mike?
Well, Jody, I'm going to defer to you in just a second. I will just tell you that when I was still kind of on the front line, we were trying to consolidate the listserv so that we didn't have the Dallas listserv and the Austin listserv. There was just one general one because, again, like our attorney from Houston that represented somebody in Amarillo, you know, geography isn't as much of a factor. Although I would expect, and this is where I'll pitch it to Jody, that there was an appeal that was posted from Fort Worth that would, and there were Fort Worth attorneys that were wanting to volunteer, that they would probably receive the preference to handle the case over somebody else.
I think that's right. And it's my understanding, and I just haven't checked into this in a few years, that when we push it out, it also ends up going on the state list too. But I may not have that correct, but I think so. I mean, generally what happens is the clerk's office sends it to the designated person who for a while has been at the Tarrant County Bar Association, and they forward it along to the committee. We make a recommendation one way or the other, and then the Tarrant County bar person sends the letter to the clerk's office that simply says they will or won't have pro bono counsel. And then that triggers it. But internally, once we make our recommendation to have it, it then goes out to the listserv. And I don't know if we have a local one, but I believe it gets pushed out with the state one as well.
Well, that's my next question is how does one, you know, someone who's interested in volunteering to do this kind of work get on that list so that they're getting these messages?
You can go to the Texas Appellate Section's website, which is tex_app.org. And on pro bono tab, there is a link that says, are you interested in participating? And you can click on that and submit your information to be a volunteer. And it will ask, you know, what kind of cases do you want or anything like that, which I think is a obsolete component of that sign-in link, because if you're interested in getting an email, you're going to get an email on the cases that come out. You're not going to get overwhelmed with emails. This isn't like you're getting 15 a day or anything like that, but you'll see the emails when they come out and you can delete them or you can read them. And just as a kind of a ironic aside, I've had several pro se parties fill out that form and submit it. Yes, I'm interested, you know, and what's your address, you know, and at least beauty shop or something. Unless you're Saul Goodman working at the nail salon, you are probably not the person we're looking for to fill this out, but I will pass the information on, you know. So,
well, I'm going to admit that since changing firms, I have not gone and filled that form out. And so if nothing else, but the pleasure of visiting with you and hearing about the program today, Mike, comes out of this conversation. When we're done recording, I'm going to make sure that I get my info in the system again, because y'all haven't chased me down to update my email address. So I'm going to make sure I do that. And I would certainly encourage, having handled some of these, it is exactly right what you said, Mike, that there actually is competition to take these cases. It's really incredible. And you get, you know, not only the folks who are eager to learn, but you get, you know, some established appellate lawyers chiming in too. And this is one area where, you know, no one's in competition with each other, except for maybe the opportunity to get the pro bono work. But there really is a great opportunity to collaborate. If it's a substantive area that you're not familiar with, if you need help with that, it really is. I think it's among one of the best features of our state appellate bar, our local appellate bars, just the ability and the willingness to kick in and take on a tough case that really, you know, people really are in a situation where they are out of their depth as lay people. And so it's so great to see that this program has really continued to flourish for all these years.
Well, I sure appreciate that, Todd. And I have, like I said, I've gone to Pittsburgh, I've gone to Richmond, Virginia, I've gone to Houston. I'm hoping to go to Minneapolis this spring to talk about the program. But every time I go on one of the, this is how we do it in Texas, jaunts at an ABA conference or something like that, I come home with, this is the way we can do it better. And that's just, this program is widely recognized and it does nothing but get better as we keep on pushing it forward. So,
well, whatever we can do to help promote it. And yeah, we're all about efficiency and making things better here too. So I think it's just wonderful. But I want to transition as we start nearing the end of our time together today. I do want to make sure we talk about a couple of things that make you interesting besides being the pro bono czar at various points in time in Texas. That is your particular interest in two things. One is cycling and another is rugby. Now, I knew you to be a cyclist. I knew you as being the guy that would ride his bike to and from work. When we were on the appellate section council together years ago, you would ride your bike to council meetings. And of course, we haven't been together in a couple of years. But why don't we start off with the cycling and how you got started on that and what you're doing with that these days, especially in light of your hip replacement?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, when I was in graduate school, I rode a mountain bike everywhere in Lubbock, Texas, and just lived on my bike. And
there's irony in that. A mountain bike in Lubbock, Texas, isn't that
ironic? But when we lived here in Austin, I did some mountain bike riding in different places. And then in 2006, I had pretty catastrophic knee surgery. I tore a meniscus, and when they went in for the surgery, they said that there was no cartilage in my knee whatsoever. And so they did this procedure where they put fluid in my knee that was going to take the place of the cartilage. And so I had to do stationary bike riding for a long time as physical therapy. And then, you know, one day it just occurred to me that it is offensive to ride a stationary bike in Austin, Texas, you know. And so I went out and bought a road bike and just got addicted to it. And so I started riding my bike, you know, on the weekends, on long rides. I rode my bike to my office every day when it was on 360. And then when I moved downtown, every day I would ride rain or shine, you know, from Spicewood Springs and Mesa to, you know, either 6th and Congress or 8th and West Avenue. And
wow.
Just loved it. It was the most peaceful thing in the world.
Yeah.
It was just so relaxing. You know, I mean, so I was doing like 18 miles a day. I was doing like 5,000 miles a year. But it's a way to decompress when I was riding after work for the day, you know. I kept changes of clothes in my office, and sometimes I would change into them. Other times I wouldn't, depending on if I was a solo or if I was going to see anybody. And then when I moved over to Enoch Kiever, I was riding home one day. And for those of you that know the Northwest Hills area, I was riding my bike up Ladera Norte, which is a very steep hill. And I had saddlebags on my bike with a big notebook. So I was probably carrying maybe 30 pounds of gear. And my Achilles tendon didn't appreciate that. And so I ended up being in a boot for, you know, 5 weeks. And that kind of kept me off the bike for a while. And then the following year, I broke my hip. I think that when we segue to rugby, there's probably a little bit of a relationship to that. But so I was basically off the bike, and I went from 5,000 miles a year to 17 miles. And it really just kind of bummed me out, you know, became more sedentary and slowly but surely transitioning back into riding. I haven't gone the century ride yet now that I'm riding again, but I'm very much hoping to do so. I had some issues with the new and improved bionic hip of clipping in and out of pedals because the torsion on the leg when you're twisting it was kind of something I had to work through physical therapy. But I'm getting there, so...
I look forward to seeing you back on the bike riding around downtown.
There's one story that when I was downtown once, I was coming down Shoal Creek and I was kind of in a goofy mood. We were at some holiday store and I bought this great big red thing that's supposed to go on your fireplace mantle. It looks like an upside down Santa hat. And I said, the opening of this is just big enough to go around my helmet. So I got some zip ties out and I put the Santa hat over my helmet. And I'm riding downtown, down Shoal Creek from like Spicewood Springs. And I get in front of the courthouse at a stoplight. And this guy pulls up next to me and says, "Were you on Shoal Creek a while ago?" And I said, "Yes." He goes, "You beat me downtown." So that was my vindication. I know it was you because you had that goofy hat on, you know.
Well, we hadn't even gotten to the war story segment yet. But that's that's almost a war story. You're beating the guy downtown on your bike. That's great. Love it. Well, talk to us about rugby, because this is something I didn't know.
Yeah, no, I started playing in right at the end of my undergraduate career at Tech and played through grad school, through law school, and just loved it. Very much enjoyed playing it. I've enjoyed watching it. Both of my sons have played at their respective colleges. My youngest son is playing at Texas State right now. My oldest son played at Reed College in Portland. And, you know, so our holiday picture was the three of us in our respective, you know, Texas Tech rugby, Reed rugby, Texas State rugby t-shirts holding our team's rugby balls. But we follow them as a family. My wife just hates athletics or hates sports as a general rule, just bored by them, but loves rugby. And she and I actually went to Washington, D.C. this weekend and saw the U.S. men's team play the New Zealand team. And I have never in my life seen a sporting event that was so lopsided. We got clobbered. I think that the New Zealand rugby team scored more than the USA basketball team scored when they played New Zealand in basketball. It was just a bad day for the US rugby team. So, but, you know, we traveled. My son played at there's a national tournament every year. And he went to Las Vegas and played in it with his school, and they did great. And, you know, the amateurs play during the day, and the international teams play at the stadium in Las Vegas at night, and just had a blast doing that. So that's just kind of our family family thing. We're big on the rugby. So once you watch it and once you figure out the rules, it's hard to go back to football, I just got to say.
That's really cool.
I know it's unpopular for me to say that in the great state of Texas. I'm a Red Raider in Austin. I'm deadly living in Holy Land.
Oh, my gosh.
We're kind of reaching the end of our time, and our tradition is to always ask for a tip or a war story. So do you have something you'd like to share?
Oh, gosh. How about just a tip? And this is just a throwaway, and it's just I've used it to start papers before, but it goes back to a quote from Justice Pope when a young lawyer was asking him for advice on what's the one piece of advice you can give me to best improve my chances for success on appeal. And Justice Pope, and you know, this is may just be lore, but he apparently said, have the word appellee for your client's name.
He wasn't wrong.
Those are words to live by. So.
Well, that's great.
It is. And thank you so much.
Hey, it's been my pleasure. I really enjoyed this. And thank you guys for doing this.
And sign up for the pro bono list if you haven't signed up, Todd.
That's right.
That's right. I'll do it right now so I get some preference, hopefully. Probably not. But I'd be glad to have some competition for that. So we'll drop a link in the show notes to the sign up. So Mike, thanks again. We really appreciate you coming on.
All right, folks. Thank you very much. Enjoyed it very much. Y'all take care.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.